At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com. Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com. The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Welcome to Warden's Watch Wild, where we talk to wildlife professionals. Brought to you by the Village Gun Store, Whitefield, New Hampshire. I'm your host, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch Wild. And we're back with Jill Kilborn, New Hampshire Fish and Game, on Warden's Watch Wild. And this time, we are going to talk about, I want to say the Canadian lynx, but now I'm like, is it like the goose? You know, it's the Canada goose, but it is the Canadian lynx, right?
I believe Canadian.
I mean, that just threw me there because I just went to about to talk about the Canadian lynx. And I'm like, wait a second, is it the Canada lynx or?
Yeah.
I think, but when I hear lynx, it's usually Canadian lynx. So,
yeah. And maybe. I just call it lynx.
Yeah.
Let's but go with it.
Is the proper North American term, though, just lynx?
Lynx canadensis. So.
So it is. Has a little bit of Canada in there somewhere. So
there you go.
Yeah. So either way, I like I said, you think you're right. And certainly our lynx population is right on that border with Canada.
Yes. Yes.
It's fascinating. I, you know, being able to work the border patrol up there and working the border, I know I reached out to you on several times to, you know, let you know where I saw tracks and things like that in the snow.
Yeah.
And you guys actually did a lot of work up there with our good friend Alex A, who hopefully will be on this show as well.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. So Alex A got done with his work on Martin that we were working with him, and him and I had many long trips of riding in the truck where we would have discussions and like pie in the sky things that we wanted to do. And lynx often came up. Alex A did some work in Maine when they were doing the original research back in the early 2000s on lynx. And so we both kind of got our brains together and decided that we wanted to try and do something with lynx in New Hampshire. And at the same time as those discussions were happening, ironically, we were starting to getting more occurrences of lynx in New Hampshire. So it was probably in the 2010 kind of range, we started getting people seeing lynx tracks in different places, photos of lynx. It was just as trail cameras were kind of switching over from a lot of film and the expense of dealing with film cameras.
Well, that was a game changer.
To when it really became digital. And that's when, you know, trail cameras really took off.
Yeah.
Alex A and I kind of started to tackle figuring out a way to deploy cameras throughout where we thought lynx could be in northern New Hampshire. And it kind of snowballed and ended up being his PhD work that he just got done with here in the past year or so.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty cool animal and very, again, habitat specific, food specific.
Exactly. So 99% of the lynx's diet is made up of snowshoe hare. So wherever you have snowshoe hare populations is, or snowshoe hare populations dense enough to support a lynx population is where lynx will pop up. Mm-hmm. And so that was another component of Alexei's work, was not only figuring out where the lynx were, but also figuring out what the snowshoe hare densities were and whether they could support lynx in the different places in northern New Hampshire. We did some work in the Whites, where we deployed a bunch of cameras in the high elevation forests of the Whites, and then also did some pellet counts specifically for snowshoe hare. So you go out and you count the number of pellets in a certain area, and depending on the number of pellets you find determines the density of snowshoe hare at that location.
Okay.
So we did that in the Whites, and then we did it in another location in Vermont, and then we did it in the very northern tip of the state up in Pittsburgh, in some of our softwood forests up there to figure out what the densities were. And sure enough, snowshoe hare densities weren't high enough in the White Mountain National Forest, but they were up in Pittsburgh to support lynx. And lo and behold, that's where our biggest population of lynx, we feel like, is up in that northern tip of the state.
Did you ever document any lynx in the White Mountain National Forest?
We did. So okay. We actually got a couple photos on a couple of our cameras, awesome. And then we had a couple reports that came in of people that found tracks, but they were never on a consistent basis like we were getting in other portions where we knew we had snowshoe hare density.
So are those lynx traveling to get food there?
Probably working their way through, finding small populations of hare, but never, like, it seems like consistently staying in those locations. It was just more of a movement through. Yeah, mm-hmm. For sure.
Thinning out the hares and then moving on when food gets scarce.
Lynx naturally, I think, especially when you get bumps in the population where you get lots of individuals, you'll get animals that are kind of ranging out and expanding the distribution of that population. So probably partly that, or animals that are just searching for new habitat. So working their way through, and when they find a pocket, then they'll hunker down in that pocket.
And when we did find those populations, can you guesstimate a population in northern New Hampshire, or was it, I mean, did it, they don't know borders. They don't know that if they're heading to Canada, they're heading to Maine, they're heading to Vermont, in
exactly.
That country. It's so close there, they can be in every place there.
You know, I tend not to try and make population
guesstimates.
Guesstimates. Because when I tried to do it for Martin, working with Alexei again on his master's work, you know, I said we had a certain number in the area where he was doing his work, and he doubled essentially the numbers that we had there. But yeah, I think the biggest thing to know whether or not we have them is whether or not we're seeing young.
Mm.
And we have documented that in quite a few locations in New Hampshire where we actually have an adult lynx traveling with 2-3 kittens on the cameras. And that, I think, is the better indication of whether or not the population is here and how consistently they're using an area.
Right. And once we documented the population, then we took some restrictions with trapping and things like that, correct?
Exactly. So once we figured that we had a consistent population, we created like a lynx exclusion zone to minimize the risk of catching a lynx in a trapper's trap. And specifically the body gripping traps are the ones that we're most concerned about, because those are the ones that would kill a lynx if it was to actually stick its head in one of those traps. So in the northern part of the state, essentially from the White Mountain National Forest north through Pittsburgh, we have restrictions that the trappers have to have their traps up off the ground. I think it's above 5 feet off the ground on a pole that under a certain diameter that a lynx is less likely to climb up. And these are restrictions that have been tested and are used in Maine, because they have similar issues in Maine and a much bigger lynx population over in Maine.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, very, very interesting. And lynx and bobcats, do they interact? Do you not find them in the same areas, or do you? Or
yeah, typically they kind of separate themselves on kind of a habitat kind of basis. Again, you know, bobcats are not built for deep snow kind of northern conditions. So their feet are pretty small, and they tend to punch through the snow and have a really hard time when you get those deep snow conditions. Like, as you know, as a warden, dealing with people having bobcats coming to chicken coops and things like that in the wintertime, or showing up under a bird feeder, it's really when those snow conditions get so bad that they have a hard time hunting and they can't get the food that they need in the wintertime. Lynx, on the other hand, super big feet. They're built like a giant snowshoe hare. Yeah. If you look at their rear legs, and they're just built for cruising on top of the snow and hunting snowshoe hare. So in those deep winter conditions, they actually outcompete bobcat and can actually do quite well in those conditions.
Yeah, I remember I took a photo of what I thought was a lynx track, and I sent it to Will Stetz, one of our other biologists, and he's like, yeah, no, bobcat. So, and then when I saw a lynx track for the first time, I was like, oh,
wow,
my goodness. Talk about having a snowshoe on your foot. I mean, it's an incredibly big track that lets them float on top of the snow, designed for that. So I get it once I saw it, but it took that long to see one.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, wow, that's a lynx track. And I'll have to post something so people can see the difference, because it's amazing.
I have some photos I can definitely share with you. But awesome. The thing that kind of is telltale for me is, and not always the track shows this, but it often looks like a snow cone or like a ice cream cone. So you get like that big kind of puffy foot in the front, and then it's almost like the back part of their foot that registers in the track. So it looks like a ice cream cone kind of in the snow type
thing. Yeah. No, oh, yeah. I'll have to, never made that correlation, but we'll definitely have to look at that. So, yeah, very, very neat animals, very minor population compared to other things in the state, for sure.
Yeah.
Threatened in the state of New Hampshire?
So they're state endangered in New Hampshire, but federally threatened. So it is one of the only mammals that we have that's federally listed as well in New Hampshire. Yeah, it's got protections at both levels. At the federal level, they've started to consider potentially delisting lynx because, as you know, the population in Maine seems to be doing quite well, and actually much better than anybody thought after they did the research back in the 2000s, the early 2000s. But there's a bunch of distinct populations across the country, and so they have to consider all those populations in that listing process. So they're kind of in the process of trying to establish goals for those different populations.
Mm-hmm.
Then they have to assess whether they're meeting those goals before they can actually make that delisting decision.
Right. And probably in New Hampshire, we are a long ways away from doing something like that because of habitat, right?
Well, yeah. So our population of lynx is we're at the very southern extent of lynx distribution. So we're never going to have like a huge population of lynx here in New Hampshire. We're going to see them when we have the appropriate habitat. So if we have a bunch of young regenerating, really dense softwood, so spruce and fir stands that are supporting a bunch of snowshoe hare, then that's when we're going to see lynx on our landscape. If our forests mature, we lose those densities of snowshoe hare, then there's no reason for the lynx to stay here. They're going to want to like move on to other places where they can actually find the food that they depend on so heavily. So it's really maintaining that habitat on our landscape to maintain that species. And I think if the lynx got delisted federally, then, you know, we'd look at where we'd want to put it on our state.
We'd establish something, some kind of quota or
bar. So or bar where we want, where our expectation is for the species in the state. If we have a federally listed species, it's automatically put on our state list. If it's not federally listed, then we have a whole system for evaluating how to put species on the state list.
I think that's interesting, because I don't think a lot of people understand that there's the state can list them and the federal government can list them. So
exactly.
You always hear about the endangered species list. It's usually on a federal level, not on a state level.
Exactly.
Where, you know, I'll use the marten, for example, that large populations in Maine, trapped, harvested, New Hampshire, not. So
yeah, formally listed for a very long time, never listed in Maine. So yeah, two very different scenarios, but same species, very close populations.
Yep. And the same research that went into marten would go into lynx in order to establish those types of things.
Exactly. Yep. And that's the responsibility of our non-game and endangered species program. That's part of the Fish and Game Department, as they kind of think about all those species and those interrelations and how it works.
Yep. And working with these species like lynx, I mean, it's tricky because, A, they are pretty remote. I remember, you know, when you leave the office, you get a good hour and a half, 2 hour ride, and then you get on a snowmobile to go out to look at these cameras, to maintain them. I know one time I had the Border Patrol, they caught some lynx on cameras, and I'm like, send those to Jill Kilbourne, and they sent them, and you were all excited that you had some more documentation, and they were all excited that they could help participate in the research.
Yeah, and it was always fun because we'd run into the Border Patrol cameras and get buzzed by the helicopter every once in a while, or get a random phone call from somebody who's like, oh, you went by this camera. And we're like, yep, that was us.
Yeah, no doubt. So, no. And working in that environment, that's just a cool when we start reaching up to our northern part of the state, because it is a different world that Lynx live in.
Yeah, and it's a remote part of the state, which is really, really cool part of the state to work in. And just like you said, it's not an easy task to get out there and do some of this stuff, because it's definitely takes a little bit more thought and effort to get out to some of those locations for sure.
Yeah, and so. Mechanical, so the snowmobile breaks down, you're probably done for the day.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just getting that out of there is the project.
We've had a few recovery missions.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want people to know all the hard work that goes into this research and stuff. And it's exciting work. I've watched you through your career and with the Martin and with the Lynx and everything, and I'm always excited to learn what you've learned.
So. Well, we also appreciate all of the collaboration, because just like you said, some of those Border Patrol sightings were really important for where we decided to put cameras. So it was a great relationship, and appreciate that as well.
Oh, that's cool. Well, thanks for taking some time and talking about the Lynx population here in northern New Hampshire, and Lynx in general too. And now I'm going to have to look up their official names though.
Yeah. No, ask Alex. I'm sure he knows.
I'm sure. Thank you.
Welcome to Wardens Watch Wild, where we talk to wildlife professionals. Brought to you by the Village Gun Store, Whitefield, New Hampshire. I'm your host, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Wardens Watch Wild.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. Birds up in the
sky. I'm Will Cooper, host of HuntStand's Make Your Mark podcast. For even more content, be sure to watch the original films from HuntStand Presents on the Waypoint TV channel every Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern. Visit waypointtv.com to learn more.